You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, July 13th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Ari Berman, senior reporter at Mother Jones covering voting rights, author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America, on the state of the vote. Meanwhile, Texas Democrats deny Republicans quorum again in a bid to stop their voting restrictions. Several men involved in the Haitian assassination of President Moise were apparently U.S. law enforcement informants. Cuban government arrests at least 100 in the wake of protests. And in the midst of a COVID explosion, Tennessee fires its top vaccine official for promoting vaccinations. Biden public land drilling approvals reach oil man G.W. Bush levels. And monthly payments to families with children begin now. Check your bank accounts. NYCHA, the largest public housing agency in the country, apparently ignored ventilation warnings during the pandemic. 2,000 member strong SEIU strike into the third week for Cook County, Illinois employees. And the House Democrats want to meet with Angela Merkel over the German blockade of the vaccination patent waiver. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us. I'm here, of course, with Emma Vigeland. Hello, Emma.
Hello, Sam. Angela Merkel.
What did I say?
That's what you said.
Angela Merkel. Did I say Andrea?
Yeah.
Well, I call Brendan Brenda. I mean, it's, look, everybody knows what we're talking about.
You're right, right. It's
I don't need to, we don't need to be formal about this.
Accuracy over precision.
Thank you very much.
Good work, Matt.
Did I say Moise right?
Yep.
Yeah. Who else is doing that in the media? Nobody.
Yes, certainly so, not Sam from yesterday.
There you go. Well, all right, Emma. Let's see, we're keeping score around here. Yeah, that's good to know.
I'm going a little hard. I apologize.
Yeah, that's all right. It's a little early in the day for that, but we will get there. Thanks for joining us, folks. Again, apologies to Angela Merkel. I know she's a fan of the show, and whenever we bring her name up and I get it wrong, she gets a little upset. We have Ari Berman on today. We've got a lot to talk about. We are just, let me put this in a sports metaphor. The pitcher is taking the mound, and the pitcher is just about to start his or her wind up in terms of the infrastructure bill. We're in the wind up phase, really almost just in the first rock back off of the rubber, as it were. So we're going to have more to talk about that in the coming days. But the big issue right now, and to some extent, we're hearing a lot of this because of what's happening in Texas. A lot of this because of what happened with the Supreme Court, but also from a legislative perspective, there is a sense that the infrastructure bill is at least on the right track, that between the bipartisan bill and the reconciliation, there are no Democrats that need to get on board outside of maybe, you know, maybe a reluctant Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. But I would imagine at this point, there is a sense within the Democratic caucus that we have them, those two votes, for at least a big chunk of what we already have decided on. The real extant issue is, what are Democrats going to do about the franchise, the votes? We have seen, and Ari Berman will tell us the details on this, an onslaught of voting restrictions across the country. And this is just the beginning. The Supreme Court has made it very clear as to how open they are to disenfranchising people. And the real question is ultimately going to be, what are the Democrats going to do about it? Are they going to do anything about it?
Biden's supposed to be giving a speech about this, and my prediction is it's going to be gobbledygook. Like, what can you do without outright calling for an end to the filibuster, which he's not going to do?
Well, this is the bottom line. And this is the bottom line, ultimately. What are they going to do about it? Are they going to give a gobbledygook speech or even a good speech? Here is Texas State Representative Rafael Anchia. And this is at least what the Texas Democrats are doing. Every time Greg Abbott is calling into session, calling the lawmakers into session to vote on a restrictive voting rights bill, the Democrats have said, we're going to leave, and you're not going to
deny you quorum.
Deny you quorum. Yeah. And here is that one of those Democrats right now.
And we are not going to buckle to the big lie in the state of Texas, the big lie that has resulted... that has resulted in anti-democratic legislation throughout the United States. We said no when the big lie came to the Capitol in Texas and darkened our door. We said no during the regular session, and we are saying no during the regular session.
And the thing to remember is, in Texas, you know, these guys, they're not full-time lawmakers as far as I know. And so they're not there that often.
And there's a finite period of time by where anything can get passed in Texas.
However, Governor Greg Abbott, who, remember now, is facing a challenge from his right flank. Is it Alan West?
Yeah.
Used to be from Florida. Abbott is now saying that he's going to continue to call special sessions. Here is Greg Abbott.
What the House of Representatives can do, the Speaker can do, is issue a call to have these members arrested. In addition to that, however, I can and I will continue to call special session after special session after special session all the way up until election next year. And so if these people want to be hanging out wherever they're hanging out on this taxpayer paid junket, they're going to have to be prepared to do it for well over a year. As soon as they come back in the state of Texas, they will be arrested. They will be cabined inside the Texas Capitol until they get their job done.
This is going to get interesting. So the bottom line is the Texas state legislature meets for up to 140 days in every odd number year. So, you know,
a system that makes sense.
Of course, right. Odd number years are the ones that desperately need legislation. And but the governor can convene lawmakers for a 30-day special sessions. And I think he can maybe do an unlimited one. It's going to be interesting to see what happens with this whole arresting and all of that stuff. I mean, this harkens back, and there was a poster right up there when Wisconsin lawmakers did this in the 2011, trying to stop Scott Walker from turning Wisconsin into a right to work state. Now, the difference here, in addition to the specifics on the ground in the Senate, in the state, is that, broadly speaking, there's a lot more sort of national support for what's going on in Texas within the Democratic Party. Barack Obama famously said he would walk, put on his walking shoes, soft walking shoes, and walk with people who were protesting. And they never came to the aid of those folks out in Wisconsin. The question is Joe Biden going to come to the aid of those in Texas and, frankly, all around the country? We're going to talk more with Ari Berman in a moment about that very topic.
Right. But this is, I mean, just quickly, this is a demonstration of how Democrats can use their leverage even when they're not in power. And on the national level, they are in power. So.
All right. To quick break. We'll be right back with Ari Berman. Folks, I don't do a tremendous amount of writing these days. Sometimes I do, sporadically. But even when I do Twitter or whatnot, something like that, I want it. Well, first of all, Twitter's, you know, it's got a character limit. So you want to be able to express what you're expressing in a certain amount of things. And I have found a, well, I have found it. They came and they said, you know, is this something that you'd be interested in advertising? And I said, let me check it out. And it's really cool. It is called WordTune. And it's basically, it's artificial intelligence, but it's basically like having a, I don't know, they don't call it this, but for me, it's like having a writing coach. It is AI powered. It understands what you're, it's, this is not like a grammar correction or a spell check. It understands what you're trying to convey. And it basically gives you suggestions on how you might present this idea in a different way or in a modified way. It uses the most advanced language processing technology out there. There's no other writing tool that I've ever seen online that can do what WordTune can do. It's ideal, I would imagine, for professional writers who are looking for an edge. Even if you're a manager and you got to write an email or you're just writing an email to somebody, or, you know, like this is, I would imagine for students also a great tool to use. For me, I don't always take the suggestion that WordTune gives me, but it makes me think about what I am trying to convey in a different light. There are times I do, but there are other times the exercise of it in and of itself. You know, the hackneyed thing they used to say about writing was it's all about your rewriting. And on some level, this process like speeds that process up. It's pretty good. You got to check it out. WordTune works anywhere you're working online. You can download the applet and put it right into your browser, or you can go to the site itself. For me, I'm actually really liking it embedded in my browser. But it works anywhere you're working online: Google Docs, Slack, Outlook Web, WhatsApp, more. And my listeners can try WordTune for free at wordtune.com/majority. That's wordtune.com/majority. Get help writing your emails, your reports, your presentations, your resumes, your blogs, whatever you're writing. And you can do it today. Go to WordTune, WordTune.com/majority. Check it out. Really, it's actually sort of fun to play with, too. So check that out. Meanwhile, we are back. Sam Cedar and Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. And joining us, once again, Ari Berman, senior reporter at Mother Jones, author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. Hello, Ari. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, guys. Sorry that the technical difficulties are like the technical difficulties to our democracy right now, I guess.
That is a wonderful way for you.
What
to
a segue!
Start with a perfect metaphor. Thank you, Art. Let me ask you this, and I probably have asked you this over the years multiple times, and the question becomes almost more sadly, more salient each time we talk. When you wrote Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America, were you writing, didn't you think that was the end of it, right? I mean, this was before this major, major assault on the vote. Like, did you anticipate that your expertise in voting rights would be called upon over and over and over again because of this onslaught?
I mean, as an author, you'd like to think that your books will have an impact, but you also hope that, like, at some point you'll outlive them. So, I mean, like, did I expect 6 years after my book came out that the Supreme Court would gut the rest of the Voting Rights Act and that Joe Biden would have to give another major speech about voting rights and that Texas Democrats would have to flee the state again to protect the right to vote? Like, no, I didn't think we were headed to this point. Did I think we'd see a candidate try to just outright overturn an election and then incite an insurrection when that didn't work? Like, no, I like what we were talking about back then was really bad. What we're talking about now is a whole nother level of insanity when it comes to voting rights. And it's this paradoxical thing because on the one hand, there's a lot more attention to voting rights than there were before, but that's also happening because the right to vote has become so much more precarious than it was before. And so it's like this weird thing where, yes, it's great that it's getting so much attention, but the only reason it's getting so much attention are because things keep getting worse and worse.
All right. Let's start with the latest Supreme Court rulings, or even let's start before then. How many, let's talk about just so broadly speaking, this is all coming out of the assault on Section 5, which I think was in 2013 now, yes. I guess, by the Supreme Court, where it took off the preclearance requirements for, I think it's about, I don't know, 16 counties across the country, in 12 states, you can correct me. For the preclearance. But, and then we just saw this massive onslaught of voting restriction bills. Where are we since, let's say, the beginning of this year, or since the 2020 election, in terms of bills that have squeezed the right to vote?
So what the Supreme Court did is it said in 2013 that states with the longest histories of discrimination no longer had to approve their voting changes with the federal government. That affected 16 states, 9 entire states with a history of discrimination, places in the South and West, and then parts of 7 other states, including some parts of the North. And that basically opened the floodgates to voter suppression in places like Texas and Georgia, because if they wanted to enact a law, for example, in Texas that said you could vote with a gun permit or not, but not a student ID, that no longer had to be pre-cleared with the federal government. Or if Georgia wanted to purge hundreds of thousands of people from the voter rolls or close 200 polling places, that no longer had to be cleared with the federal government. And then what happened this year is there's been a dramatic acceleration of those efforts. So we actually crunched the numbers. So I'll give you 2 different sets of numbers. From that 2013 decision to today, 26 states have made it harder to vote, including 10 states that were previously subject to the Voting Rights Act. In this year alone, 17 states have made it more difficult to vote in past 28 new laws doing so. So basically, there's this continuum, right? There's efforts to make it more difficult to vote before the Supreme Court guts the Voting Rights Act. There's more efforts to make it harder to vote after the Supreme Court guts the Voting Rights Act. Then those efforts dramatically accelerate after Trump tries to overturn the election. All these state legislatures get back in session and try to weaponize the big lie through other means. And that's what we're seeing in Georgia, Texas, Florida, Iowa, Montana, et cetera, right now.
There is, I think, I mean, and we don't hear this too much, but I mean, Trump accelerated this, but this was a, we should be clear. This was a Republican phenomenon, right? I mean, the, and I can't remember his name now, but the godfather of redistricting, the Republican operative who passed away, whose daughter, who was estranged from his daughter, and she handed over these hard drives, essentially, or exposed them. I mean, just talk briefly about that element of this, because he was a longtime Republican operative. This is a Republican agenda, and how that agenda has just changed more in how naked it is. There's no veneer is really the only difference.
Yeah, you're talking about Tom Hoffler, who was the longtime Republican gerrymandering expert who basically figured out ways to racial gerrymander to protect white power and to hurt Democratic power in places like North Carolina. So you can have a 50-50 state, but there's 13 Republicans and two Democrats. I mean, that's kind of like the genius of what he did. That's gerrymandering, but I mean, it's two sides of the same coin with voter suppression. And basically, I mean, you can go back a very long way. I mean, I talk in my book about how people like John Roberts in the 1980s were trying to weaken the Voting Rights Act. But certainly, a lot of this accelerated in the last decade. And really, first off, it was a response to Barack Obama's election, that when Republicans took control of all of these key states in 2010, the first thing they did was make it harder to vote and then also gerrymander to entrench their own power. So things like widespread voter suppression in places like Wisconsin, that predated Trump. But as you say, Trump just said the quiet part out loud. And what was different about Trump versus other aspects is Trump just tried to blatantly overturn an election, right? And that was more than Republicans had been willing to do in places like Wisconsin and North Carolina. So the anti-democratic tendencies were there, but then Trump took it to a whole nother level. And then he really made voter suppression the central rallying cry of the Republican Party, because these efforts were kind of fringy before then. Like, there wasn't a leader to the effort. There were state legislative Republicans that were doing this, or there were people like Tom Hoffler, right, who were doing this, obscure GOP strategists. You didn't have a Trump-like figure that was going around the country saying, let's throw out all the mail ballots. Let's cut off all the early voting days. Let's make sure we get all the votes thrown out in Detroit and Philadelphia and Milwaukee, where all the Black voters live. I mean, that was really a Trump-like phenomenon. But I think the more disturbing part of it is basically that the Republican Party is succeeding where Trump failed right now, because they're going through the normal channels. I think what they learned from 2020 is, if you try to do this in an irregular way and in a blatantly illegal way, the courts aren't going to allow it. Some Republicans won't even stand up for it. But if you just try to rig the election ahead of time through the normal political channels, well, we can do that. And by the way, everyone in the Republican Party will basically be invested in it, that you might have a Georgia Secretary of State stand up and tell Donald Trump the election was fair. But that same Georgia Secretary of State is going to go along with his party's restrictions on voting. And basically, they realize that this strategy is ultimately going to be a lot more successful than to just throw out the votes after the election strategy.
In some ways, I mean, what Trump did was he gave the Republicans room to sort of move for he. I mean, he basically drew a new line as to how far out you can get away with stuff. And we just saw, we played a clip yesterday of Rick Scott at CPAC. And when they were talking about Republican values, the first thing he said was, election reform was a major Republican value. I want to remind people, like, to the extent that there have been any problems with elections, it is not addressed by a single thing that any of these people have proposed. I mean, they have created this problem. All right, so let's go to the most recent Supreme Court rulings. You mentioned John Roberts. In 1982, Ronald Reagan signs an amendment to Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. He does so over the advice that he was given to the opposite by a lawyer in the Department of Justice named John Roberts. Talk about a guy with a mission. May we all be so lucky to want something and 40 years later be in a position to actually just almost unilaterally make it happen. And John Roberts did just that, didn't he?
Yeah, in 40 years, you too, Sam, can achieve your dream of destroying the Voting Rights Act. But what happened was, John Roberts, like Samuel Alito, they were foot soldiers in the Reagan Revolution. They wanted to roll back the civil rights laws of the 1980s. There was a Supreme Court case in 1980 that basically said you had to show intentional voting discrimination to be able to strike down a discriminatory voting system, which was very, very difficult to prove. You had to have smoking gun evidence of someone basically saying, yeah, I passed this to disenfranchise Black voters, which by 1980, 15 years after the Voting Rights Act was passed, people had sort of stopped doing that kind of thing. So this was a very weak blow to the Voting Rights Act. Congress overruled the Supreme Court and basically said you just had to show that a discriminatory voting plan had the impact of discriminating against a minority group, not the intent of discrimination, which was a lot easier to prove. And then they not only changed that language, but they restored the Voting Rights Act for 25 years, neither of which Ronald Reagan really wanted to do. He didn't really want to sign a new Voting Rights Act, and he certainly didn't want to sign a strengthened Voting Rights Act. But there was a bipartisan consensus in Congress that does not exist now. There were influential Republicans like Bob Dole that worked with liberals like Ted Kennedy to draft a new Voting Rights Act, a coalition that's completely just evaporated today. And so what happens is basically...
Ari, there, yeah. I remind people too that that dynamic in the 15 years after the Voting Rights Act is approved, the idea of proxies being used as proxies for race, being used as restrictions on voting, was exactly what we saw following Reconstruction, right? I mean, that is the Jim Crow era where the Supreme Court was like, you know, actually literacy tests and poll taxes, that's not so bad. And that regime lasted for 70 years in some instances.
Yeah, because what happened is places like Mississippi and Alabama, when they wrote literacy tests and poll taxes, they used really racist rhetoric. But the legislation itself was race blind, meaning that the literacy test never said we're only going to prevent Black people from voting, but exempt white people from this requirement. So the Supreme Court could then say there's nothing explicitly racist about this, ignoring the entire design of the law, but just narrowly looking at the text. And of course, that's how they were able to uphold things like literacy tests and poll taxes for so many years. So basically, John Roberts loses this fight in the 1980s. Then he becomes Chief Justice. And in 2013, he weakens. Well, he gets rid of this requirement that states have to approve their voting changes with the federal government. But he says there's this other part of the Voting Rights Act, Section 2, that applies nationwide, which he targeted in the 1980s. He says this part still exists. We're not touching this part of it. But of course, you knew once they touched one part, they were going to get after the other part. And so they have this incredible bait and switch where 8 years after gutting one part of the Voting Rights Act, they then gut the other part of the Voting Rights Act that they swore they would not touch. And basically, they do exactly what Roberts wanted in 1982. They make it functionally impossible to strike down racist voting systems unless you're going to be able to produce smoking gun evidence of racism, which, by the way, it's not even clear this court would recognize that as racist, given the kind of things that Samuel Alito says. And so it's just amazing to me. You know, Roberts and Alito are working together in the Reagan administration 40 years ago. And basically, this has been their project for the last 40 years. And they've been almost entirely successful now at carrying out, at rolling back the civil rights laws of the 1960s and more than any other in terms of rolling back the Voting Rights Act. And so basically, the two pillars of the Voting Rights Act, one has been completely eviscerated. The other is essentially on life support. And so the law itself is basically on life support if Congress doesn't do anything to fix it.
Well, talk about just, though, the shifting of the burden of proving what is a racist law and what isn't, right? Because I think we need to understanding how they gutted it. So the initial Voting Rights Act, essentially, it was on the burden. It was the state's burden to prove that their laws essentially weren't racist. And now this bizarre interpretation by the conservative Supreme Court has flipped that burden to prove that these laws aren't racist, which is impossible to do, right? Because of, you know, it essentially has to be a smoking gun. The law has to say, I am racist. I don't like Black people. I don't like Hispanic people, whatever the case may be. Like, that's such an insane legal standard, but that seems to be the one that they're trending towards or barreling towards.
Yeah, I mean, basically, the Voting Rights Act was designed to protect voters from states. It was designed to protect voters of color from states, like Georgia and Alabama. And what Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act did was it put the burden on places like Georgia and Alabama to prove that they weren't discriminating. And the other part of the Voting Rights Act, Section 2, made it easy to win these kind of cases. Even if the burden of proof was on minority voters, they still had a lot of ways to win these challenges. Now, basically, Alito is saying, we are going to protect states instead of voters. We are going to protect the rights of states to do voter suppression laws over the rights of voters to be free from voter suppression laws. And we're going to do that by basically saying, as long as the state has a theoretical interest in preventing voter fraud, even if they haven't actually shown any evidence of voter fraud, that is going to be a legitimate state interest that we're going to give great deference to. Meanwhile, minority voters are going to have to clear all of these incredibly high bars to be able to prove that their burdens outweigh the state's burdens. And that's just a completely radical interpretation of the Voting Rights Act. Because as I said, the Voting Rights Act was supposed to prevent voter suppression from states in order to protect voters of color. And now what Alito essentially is saying, we are going to protect states' ability to do voter suppression instead of the voters that are facing voter suppression. And he just completely made this up out of thin air. I mean, they added what they call these guideposts to interpreting the Voting Rights Act that aren't anywhere in the congressional record supported by the Voting Rights Act. I think that's what's so frustrating to people is it wasn't even like they were relying on some sort of legal standard. I mean, they just completely made it up to justify an outcome that they wanted. And essentially what they're doing is they're institutionalizing the big lie. I mean, that's all it is. That's the same kind of stuff that Trump said. We know there's fraud. We're not going to prove it, but we know it exists. I mean, that's basically what he's saying. If Arizona or Georgia or whoever gives that defense, we're going to basically buy it.
There's a lot of stuff I want to talk about what it's going to mean for the concept of disparate impact, going forward. And also the, you know, what it means in terms of like states, you know, the state's interest, because if there is no evidence of fraud, like it lowers the bar as to what a state, not just an individual state, but literally the government can do, it seems to me, and acting upon a hypothetical as opposed to actually real world events or problems. But I want to just go back to one more thing about that two-step, because the one-step being 2013 and the two-step being 2021 or the 2020 session, they did the same thing. It seems to me with the other case that they resolved, I know this is a little bit outside of your portfolio, but the disclosure laws, Citizens United, the argument was we can allow all this money because at least we have disclosure laws. And that was found to be like, you know, there's a little hitch there. Like it's disclosed after the election. And so,
Or not at all. Yeah.
And then in this most recent ruling out of the second one that came down with this DNC one, the Americans for Prosperity, they've basically taken a hatchet to that disclosure requirement as well. This is the thing that people need to understand is that none of these cases exist as discrete entities. They become building blocks for the future. And we can say back in the Section 5 case in 2013, we saw the same thing by Scalia at that time in rejecting the explicit action by Congress. Will you just speak about that? Because the Scalia dicta in that case, where he basically said, I know the Senate reauthorized this 5 years ago, but they just did so because they were afraid of being called racist. I mean, that was basically what he said, right? I mean,
That is basically what he said. I mean, he said that the Voting Rights Act had led to what he called a perpetuation of racial entitlement. So he viewed the most important civil rights law in the U.S. history, which ended the disenfranchisement of Black voters for decades in the Jim Crow South, as becoming another what he called racial entitlement, and basically said, oh, the Voting Rights Act, it sounds so great. Who's ever going to strike it down? Basically, what he was doing was transferring the authority of the court to make judgments for Congress, because when he says, oh, it's such a great piece of legislation, you'll never change it. Well, then the only option left is, okay, well, the courts have to step in. And you're basically saying, we're going to substitute our judgment for Congress's judgment, which the court is not supposed to do, particularly if you believe in judicial restraint, right? And they've now done it twice because they ignored the large congressional record in support of Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, and they also just unilaterally rewrote the 1982 reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act in this latest case. And you're right about what these cases do, because every time there's a Supreme Court decision, people try to adjust to it, right? So people use Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act because Section 5 no longer existed. And the same thing, they added new disclosure requirements in California because of Citizens United, right? And the thing is, there's always a grand plan here. And the grand plan here is make it easier to buy elections and harder to vote in them. I mean, their ultimate future would be a system where there's no regulation of voter suppression laws and no regulation of dark money laws. I mean, that's the ultimate thing they want. Now, there's going to be some limits on it, right? But basically, they want both of these areas to be totally unregulated. They want the states to be able to do whatever they want. They want as much money as they want, because that ultimately serves the things they care about, which is advancing the ideology of the Federalist Society, which is put power into as few and few hands as possible, essentially the hands of rich white conservative men. And that's what both of these decisions will have the impact of ultimately doing here. And so the decisions really go together in a very neat way. And you start to ask yourself, you know, what's the point of trying to respond to things the court's doing if the court, when you respond to them, is just going to say, we're going to take away that avenue as well down the line? And that's, again, where I think that congressional action, plus, honestly, some sort of changing or reforming of the courts has to happen. And it looks like Democrats are going to do neither. So they basically just let the 6-3 court do whatever they want for decades.
If it remains a 6-3 court, right? I mean, Justice Breyer has made it clear that he is going to resist any attempt to sort of acknowledge the reality. And let's talk a little bit about that. There was a piece I was just reading by Emma Green in The Atlantic about the judicial picks, and there is a coming realization on some level, maybe, that the Democrats have been, I think this is from the piece, chumps. They've been bamboozled, some people would argue they've been purposely naive. But I look at a guy like Russ Feingold, and I feel quite comfortable in saying, as the former senator from Wisconsin, not a corporatist, was a very much of a sincere institutionalist, would vote for Republican nominees as a matter of principle, because he was an institutionalist. And yet he is now the head of the American Constitution Society and seems to have an awareness of, like, you know what, we got played. And that seems to be what's happening with the voting rights. I mean, like, what, outline for us, let's say for a moment, you have the ability, you know, Biden comes to you and says, you know what, Ari, I've seen you so many times in the Majority Report that I'm convinced. What should I do? What should we do?
I mean, basically, he needs to lock Manchin and Sinema in a room and say to them, do you want to be the two senators that allowed Jim Crow 2.0 to happen all across the country? That this isn't about Senate rules. It's about the fact that Republicans are trying to take voting rights back 100 years. We're going to lose our majorities because of it. We're going to have no ability to do anything for the next 2 years and beyond. We're probably going to lose power in 2022 and 2024 if that happens. And we have a very short window to act. And basically, you're allowing a Senate rule that's not actually in the Constitution anywhere to trump the ability to enforce all of the constitutional guarantees for voting rights that do exist in the Constitution. I think that's really the only option here, because everything else that Biden wants to do on voting rights is not going to be successful absent congressional legislation protecting the right to vote.
Okay, that's the how. That's the how you get the vote pat. But I'm asking, what does the bill look like? How do you defend against a 6-3 court? And it's different than a 5-4 court, right? Because in a 5-4 court, you always get that one like, oh, you know, Clarence Thomas, he needs the law written in Old English, and that's his thing. And therefore, I'm not voting for the. You always, with the 5-4, there was a, you know, 40% chance that one of these idiosyncratic conservatives would be on their own personal hobby horse, is the way that they brand themselves, and they would vote against it. But with 6-3, there's no margin for that at all. So how do you write? How do you amend or reauthorize a Voting Rights Act when 10 years ago you had Scalia saying, like, I know they voted to reauthorize it, but they didn't really want to. It was just because they didn't want to look bad. In other words, they were pressured by the people, by democracy pressured them. So we're going to, you know, alleviate them of that sort of burden. How do you write legislation when you have, I want to say it's a headwind, but it's not a headwind. It's like a meat grinder on the other end of it.
Well, I mean, theoretically, Congress has the authority to do both the For the People Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Act under the authority they have, meaning that they have their ability to set the time, place, and manner for federal elections, meaning the rules for federal elections. So that would all fall under the For the People Act. And John Roberts explicitly said when he gutted the Voting Rights Act, Congress has the power to draft a new one, which is what they're doing. Now, how do you court proof it? That's something that nobody knows, Sam. That's why I've been focused on what they have the power to do, which is change the Senate rules to pass these pieces of legislation, because that's something that they can actually control. They can have a simple majority vote tomorrow to pass these things. How do you court proof it? You might not be able to. You honestly might not be able to court proof it, and your only alternative is to expand the courts if the courts are just going to strike down whatever you're going to do. That, to me, is a much more difficult conversation than how do you pass it. And right now, we're still at the how to pass it stage. And I absolutely don't believe that if the roles were reversed and Democrats were systematically trying to prevent Republicans from winning elections, that Republicans wouldn't hesitate for a second to use the power they have to change Senate rules to do this, because they've already changed the Senate rules. I mean, they already changed the Senate rules for the filibuster.
That's how they got this court. That's how.
Yeah, exactly. They got the court by changing the Senate rules. But Democrats won't change the Senate rules, which are completely arbitrary, by the way. The filibuster used to be what it used to be, 67 votes. And now it's 60 votes. And it could be 55 votes. I mean, like, there's no constitutional principle you're upholding here. And why are cabinet nominations 51 votes? Why are courts 51 votes? But other legislation isn't. Why can I cut taxes for the rich with 51 votes, but I can't protect the right to vote with 51 votes? There's no internal consistency to any of this stuff. So it's just crazy to me that we're still stuck on this. And I mean, just to talk about this speech that Biden is going to give in Philly today, I mean, it seems like he's not going to go there. It really seems like he's not going to go into, we have to change the filibuster to pass these bills. And I just don't see any other path of success. What you're going to register new voters and turn out new voters when the entire point of voter suppression is to make that harder to do? You're going to litigate your way through the courts when the courts have already said that they're not going to strike down any of these laws? I mean, the president and his team don't have any power to do anything short of trying to lobby Congress to do something. And that might not work. I wrote a piece today. I said very clearly, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, their minds might not be able to be changed, but try to change it. I mean, like, in the infrastructure bill, they had stuff that said, they said, we need this in the bill. If it's not in the bill, we're not going to support it. They haven't done anything like that on the filibuster. They haven't said, for example, I want this voting rights bill passed, and I'm willing to accept these changes to the filibuster. They've said that they don't even want to change the filibuster. So if your starting point is you don't want to change the filibuster, then you're not really using a lot of political capital to put pressure on senators to change the filibuster, right? And so my argument is they haven't actually even used any political capital in order to make this argument, because it's not entirely clear they even believe that they should do it, right? Like, it's not even clear to me that they want to change the filibuster, or else he would have come out in favor of doing so.
I mean, Biden is giving the speech today because he has heard from civil rights leaders whose hair is on fire essentially over this. And is it that they don't? Is it that they don't take this voting stuff that seriously? Is it that the filibuster is so sacrosanct? Is it that Biden's feeling like I need to get the infrastructure stuff in the bank first before I start to pressure Manchin on something else, right? Because it seems to me at one point you could have a situation where you float like, oh, we can have a reconciliation style resolution for voting rights. There can be like a special mechanism to pass democracy initiatives, right? I mean, this is all just gobbledygook, but it's all gobbledygook, right? Yeah. It's just to placate them. But that at this point, the White House, and then this is complete conjecture on my part, the White House is sequencing it this way. We need to get the infrastructure bill. We need that legislation banked. Once we do that, then we can lean on Manchin and make a real show of it. And either he breaks or he doesn't. But at the very least, we get some type of, we stir up some politics about this on some level. It feels right now he's just trying to sort of let the air out of the tire rather than drive somewhere.
But the problem with that is, number one, time is running out to pass voting rights legislation, both because so much stuff has already been enacted in the states. Texas Democrats have a deadline of August 6th to have to go back there, or they're going to start another special session. And redistricting is happening in the fall, meaning that all of these states are going to redraw their maps. And if we don't have a ban on partisan gerrymandering for Congress, there are going to be crazy amounts of partisan gerrymandering going on. So they're running out of time. And also, if Biden passes an infrastructure bill with 65 votes, Joe Manchin's not going to feel any pressure to do anything about the filibuster, because he's going to say, what obstruction? We just passed this great bipartisan bill. We just built a bridge to nowhere in West Virginia. Why should I change the filibuster when I just got my bill passed? So I don't think that's ultimately going to be successful, but I do think that it's a combination of base placating, an internal debate within the administration about how big of a deal this is. Because I think if you polled five senior members of the administration, you're going to get different viewpoints of whether this voter suppression can be overcome and how it can be overcome. And the fact that they want to seem like they're getting credit for doing things without actually doing anything. And also, they don't want to have a fight over Senate rules that's going to then potentially jeopardize this bipartisan infrastructure package that Biden is so keen on doing. I mean, Biden's an institutionalist. I think he would much rather have 10 Republicans over at the White House for some chummy press conference than get into a fight over changing the Senate rules. That's never who he's been. But my point is, this is coming whether you like it or not, right? Like, you're either going to engage on the filibuster, or Republicans are going to take away your ability to be able to do anything legislatively and also to counteract the kind of suppression that we're seeing in the state. So it's coming one way or another. The question is, are you going to actually do something about it? And right now I'm seeing kind of a half-hearted effort. Maybe that'll change after the speech. Maybe I'll be blown away that he'll call for a voting rights exemption in the filibuster and he'll call out Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, but I don't see it happening.
Emma, you have an update from the New York Times about Texas there.
Yeah. So essentially, a Texas Senate aide told someone at the New York Times, Nick Corsanti, that the number of Texas Democratic senators is not enough to break quorum in the Senate, which is not initially what reporting from the Texas Tribune, I believe, said. So it seems like they're going to take up Senate Bill 1 in Texas today.
Yeah. But I mean, they're not going to take it up in the House. So it's not going to pass. Yeah. I mean, they're going to pass it in the Senate and not going to pass it in the House. I guess they did the same thing with redistricting when the Texas Democrats fled the state in 2013. In 2003, it passed one chamber and then passed another chamber. Point is, this is going to pass one way or another. It's either going to pass August 7th, or it's going to pass September 7th, or it's going to pass November 7th. This is going to pass. And the question is Congress going to do anything about it? Right? Because Texas Democrats have said we can only run out the clock so much. I mean, we fled the state. We broke quorum, then we fled the state. I mean, we can't really do much more. Now, what could Congress do? They literally could hold a simple majority vote tomorrow to change the filibuster rules to pass the For the People Act. I mean, this is so much easier than what Texas Democrats are doing. And that's the frustrating thing to people, is that Texas Democrats are in the minority and they're going to these extraordinary lengths to protest voter suppression. Congressional Democrats are in the majority and they took 2 weeks off. They're back now. There's no sense of urgency to do anything about the voter suppression that Texas Democrats are protesting. That is the thing that is frustrating to people. They don't understand why aren't Democrats using the power they have when Texas Republicans are using the power they have, which honestly is pales in comparison to what Congress and the president can do.
Do you, in the course of your reporting, do you have any insight as to like where, like why there's such a lack of urgency? Like why you don't have every, you know, 48 senators, you know, dropping by Joe Manchin's office and Kyrsten Sinema's office. I mean, it feels like it's not, there are obstacles, obviously, but it feels like there is just simply a lack of will. And this just seems, is it just there is no cohesiveness with the Democrats that they don't, there cannot be an existential threat to Democrats because there are no Democrats in quotes. There's just like some individuals who, you know, sign up under that ballot line and different points there. I'm a Democrat in this instance, but not so much in that instance. I mean, what is it?
Well, what the White House basically says is there's not support for changing the filibuster. So we're not going to go there. And it's beyond Manchin and Sinema. That it's not like two senators holding out. It's 10 or 15. It's Mark Warner. It's other people. It's Dianne Feinstein. It's other people that like should be gettable, but have reluctance to do this because they're worried it will be used against them, which I guess is an understandable fear. My issue with the White House is then try to change their mind. Like if your position is we're not going to change the filibuster, then of course Joe Manchin's position is going to be we're not going to change the filibuster. But try to change his mind. Use some political capital trying to change his mind. Don't just lay out the stakes for what's wrong here. Lay out the stakes for what Congress can do about it. And basically, you know, they had a vote on the For the People Act. It was filibustered by Republicans. Joe Biden didn't give a speech ahead of time, didn't do anything to lobby votes ahead of time. And then afterwards, said he was disappointed, but didn't talk about Republicans using the filibuster to block it. So, I mean, like, they're not using the political capital they have. Now, again, maybe there's nothing they can do, right? Maybe, as I said, Manchin and Sinema are ungettable. That's what happens when you have 50 Democrats in a Senate. You have, you know, people that don't want to go along with the playbook. And so you get them where you can get them. And they're thinking, well, if I can get Manchin on infrastructure, but I can't get him on the filibuster, I'm going to prioritize infrastructure because that's gettable for us. And also it's broadly popular and I can go sell it around the country and everyone likes roads and bridges. I get the strategy, but if you believe this is an existential threat to democracy, that this is a foundational threat to a foundational right, then you have to act like it. Right. And that means that you don't just give one speech in Philadelphia and then say, hey, you guys sort it out. You offer a roadmap for how they should sort it out. And that to me has been the piece that's been missing here is, OK, if all of you guys support it, what are you going to try to do to actually pass it? Especially because they've already filibustered it. So the obstruction has already been evident here.
I am old enough to remember May. And in May, we were told that Chuck Schumer was going to bring a series of very tough votes that were going to put pressure on Republicans. And they were all going to come in June.
It was
going to be
coalescing.
A June-orama of votes. And they may have taken those votes. They took the For the People Act. But I can't quite understand if it is how anemic their attempts to even if I had to take the most cynical position ever, which is probably not necessarily inaccurate in some instances, that they don't want these things to pass anyways. They just want the political value out of Republicans scuttling them. They didn't even do that. Like they didn't even like, where is the, I don't know, where are the events? Where's the publicity around those votes? It just seemed anemic to me.
Well, it's just crazy to me that Texas Democrats have to flee their state to persuade Democrats in Washington to do something. I mean, like, they shouldn't have to do this. They shouldn't have to flee their states, give up their salaries, risk arrest to convince Democrats to do something. Democrats should already be there. And so I think there just needs to be more sustained pressure, and the pressure has to stay sustained. And I think the Democrats showing up in Texas is going to be one pressure point. But I also think that the White House needs to do more. And we're going to see in the speech whether the White House is doing more. I don't think ultimately it's going to be enough. I think this has to be, if Joe Biden believes that this is a central cause of his presidency, a central cause of his life, he has to treat it as such.
What's the words that you would need to see in this speech that would let you believe that he is taking it seriously? The words filibuster?
I am calling on the Congress to pass voting rights legislation through any means necessary. If that means changing a Senate rule that is no longer, that is not actually in the Constitution to protect the most important constitutional right, then I believe that option should be on the table. And I'm bringing Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema and Mark Warner and Dianne Feinstein to the White House tomorrow for a summit to figure out how to pass this legislation, because failure is not an option. That's what I would say in the speech.
There it is, ladies and gentlemen.
Saying failure is not an option. Project some strength, Joe.
Chuck Schumer already said failure is not an option, but failure has already become an option because they've already blocked the bill.
Always an option with the Democratic Party.
Chuck Schumer said it this way. Failure is not an option.
Put your glasses down on your nose.
He did that.
Yeah.
Ari, hopefully Ron Klain has watched your segment today and has inserted that into Joe Biden's speech. And then Manchin will feel the heat, and Sinema will also toe the line. But in the absence of that, we will talk again about the latest assault on voting rights by Republicans. Ari Melber, the author.
Ari Melber, come on, you've known me for too long.
Whoa. Ari Berman. It's one of those days. Author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. Sorry about that, Ari.
We love Ari Melber, though. All right, talk to you later.
We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back after this. They used to both write at The Nation.
Yeah.
Oh, no, that's right. No music? All right, let's just come back. All right, we're back. I was just saying at the break that both Ari Berman and Ari Melber both wrote at The Nation back in the day. And we've been talking about the assault on voting rights so long that it brought me back to those days at The Nation. I wasn't there, but I mean, they were.
You felt like you were there.
Yep. Joe Biden will be giving that speech in Philadelphia. And again, it is the best I think that we can hope for is just that whatever the White House thinks that, you know, it is time to get the infrastructure bill done. And then they'll focus on the whole making sure that people have the right to vote and maintaining, you know, the ability for Democrats to win elections in the future. Exactly. if you're watching us on Peacock, we will see you tomorrow. There you go. The Chicago, according to Jonathan Armstead on the IM, the Chicago social worker strike ended this morning. Workers are getting an 8.5% pay increase, but will also pay more in health insurance. So that's a concession they gave up. Still at 18 days, that's the longest strike they'd ever done. So kudos. Well, thank you for that. Those are the SEIU folks in Cook County. And I'll tell you why I like the pay increase. Let me rephrase that. The in that type of situation, the pay increase and then also the more expense on the health insurance, unions need to sever their relationship with health insurance.
Yes.
For there to be Medicare for all. We cannot have a situation where unions are also an obstacle. They're not the primary obstacle. I don't think they're even necessarily a secondary obstacle. But amongst the left, there needs, if there was full-throated desire by unions, and certainly in New York State, the unions inhibited New York State's mm-hmm. push for Medicare for All. And part of that is because I think there is a fear in certain quarters in the union, in unions and union movement and unions as institutions, that their value add proposition is health insurance.
Well, it's also just the cudgel that they use in order, like often some union heads have relationships with Democratic leaders, and there's a bit of, we saw this in terms of just messaging from some Democratic politicians, they'll use union healthcare plans, which are better, as a way to fearmonger about, you know, Medicare for All and health insurance, and it has a chilling effect.
Well, they use that leverage because unions are there saying, like, well, we don't want this value add.
Right.
We don't want this value add that we offer, this valuable proposition that we offer members that entices people to become union members. We don't want that to go away.
But the solution is stronger union protections, not, you know, at the exclusion of a healthcare push.
Right. All right. We're going to take a break, head into the fun half. 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 is the number. Can't believe I said that, Ari. That was embarrassing. That's like somebody calling me Sam Stein, which happens all the time.
I think I got in your head a little bit.
Yeah.
With the roasting.
Exactly.
Yeah, that kind of.
Ari Mel Berman. Folks, just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. When you become a member at the Majority Report, you...
Ari Mel Bergmanhoff.
Exactly. 6-4... Now you got me. When you become a member of the show, you get the fun half... the free half free of commercials, and then you get the fun half every day. It is your membership that makes this show possible. Don't forget, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Also, check out our Discord, majoritydiscord.com, or our app at majorityapp.com. So many free
And Left things. Reckoning, too, right?
Well, I was going to say, Matt, what's happening in the Matt Leckian media universe?
Yeah, last night for patrons, Griscom and I talked about Cuba and also South Dakota's attorney general, who was involved in a hit and run a few months ago where he said he assumed it was a deer. Turned out it was a guy that he hit, and his glasses were in his car from his head going through the windshield. Anyway, so watch some of that testimony. And also coming up on Wednesday, we have Victor Pozgi. He's a journalist that was formerly with The Intercept in Brazil. We're going to be talking about Lula and Bolsonaro and some of his COVID vaccine scandals. So that's 8 Eastern on Wednesday now, the new night for Left Reckoning. Patreon.com/Left Reckoning to get all that bonus material.
All right, folks. See you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back, 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 back. Back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. Back, back, back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back, back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare.
Bring back DJ
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Denner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See, white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of banks. A hell of a lot of banks. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are fat, 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 fat. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are fat, 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 fat.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday. Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are black, black. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are black, black.
Come on.
To pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total pussy.